This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. From 2010 to 2019, child poverty rates in the United States had been heading downward. But there are still almost 11 million American children living in poverty. That's almost one in every seven kids in this country. Wendy Brown's kids are among that group. She's a single mother of six in Greenville, Pennsylvania. And Wendy had been working as a convenience store manager until Sunday, when she lost her job. We talked with her just hours later.
I don't think it's really set in. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've been there a year and a half, and I don't think it's really set in that she really just took my keys.
Her supervisor had just taken her keys, Wendy said. Well, Wendy went home. The house was full of kids, but she still wanted to tell her story, so she huddled into the bathroom and talked about her life over a rough phone line.
I'd get up, you know, 7:30, get kids ready for school, drop them off, go to work, go pick them up, drop them off at home, go back to work at my second job, and do it all over again. It wasn't easy.
You just heard her say that she also had a second job at one point. So Wendy is one of America's working poor. She and her five youngest kids struggled with housing. They spent 10 months staying with friends and family last year because they did not have a permanent home. But in November, they were finally able to move into a place of their own. Wendy began working just one job. It paid $10 an hour, but she struggled to make ends meet for her family of six.
You know, there's been times like, okay, what am I not paying so they eat?
What am I not paying so they eat, she said. Wendy says some help has come in the form of stimulus checks from Congress, but she says the aid didn't come fast enough.
First time, they didn't give me the money for the kids. They sent me a check like 3 or 4 months later for the kids. The second stimulus that came out, they didn't give me the money for the kids again. And the whole $600 that I got went to repair my car.
Went to repair her car, which she absolutely needs to get to work. Well, now Congress is considering a third round of stimulus payments, and tucked into the massive $1.9 trillion Biden relief package is a plan that could transform life for Wendy and her kids. It could, in fact, cut child poverty rates in this country in half. And that's not all. There are other proposals on the table. One comes from Republican Mitt Romney. So, an interesting point in American history. Major plans to pull children out of poverty. This could be a momentous shift in this country if politics don't stand in the way. But here's the reality, far away from Congress and the White House. Wendy Brown says, struggling to find work, scraping together enough to feed her kids, she's just not sure how she makes it through each day.
There's days that, I'm not going to lie, there's days I go to bed and go, how did I even make it through the day? Like, how did I manage it? But, you know, my kids, of course, will always come first, always have. Can't tell you the last time I bought something for myself because everything goes to my kids, and I'm okay with that. Like, that's totally fine. I just want them to succeed in life and not have to struggle the way I am.
That's Wendy Brown. She spoke to us from her home in Pennsylvania. Well, today, we're going to dig through these proposals to cut child poverty in the United States. What's different between them, what they could accomplish, what they won't accomplish, and what is standing in the way of their passage and a potentially historic change for the lives of millions of American children. Joining us today is Jamila Michener. She's a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research focuses on poverty, racial inequality, and public policy in the United States. She's also author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Professor Michener, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I would like to start by just really digging into the plan that's in President Biden's proposal for that $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. What exactly do they aim to do that would fulfill this claim that could cut child poverty in half?
I think the goal of the plan is to provide resources to families in need. And, you know, I teach a class on poverty, and I always tell my students that in many ways, poverty is a complex problem. But in some ways, it's all also very straightforward, which is that when you give people more money, you pull them out of poverty, right? And I think that that's some of the logic of this plan, is that if we give families, you know, through the IRS, through the tax code, benefits, and it's tied to, you know, the number of children that you have, the age of those children, and it is fully refundable, meaning that, you know, the amount, if the amount of the credit is larger than the tax you owe, you still get the difference, right? So we're maximizing how much we're getting to these families. We're increasing the amounts that, that we're already giving through child tax credits, and we're changing the way it's given so that it's fully refundable. Those are really just efforts to maximize the amount that families get. And that's how we're going to pull more children and more families out of poverty, by giving them more resources. It's really quite straightforward in that sense.
Okay, so that's the big picture sort of equation here. But specifically, and, you know, as you well know, Professor, in Washington, the devil is always in the details. So I want to get the details straight here. So the Biden plan, or at least the plan that's in the COVID relief bill, would give caregivers of children, I'm seeing here, $3 a month for each child under six, $250 a month for older children, but at least only for the next year. It's not sure, we're not sure beyond that, but the key thing is, it would be a is it a direct payment to families?
Yeah, so it's a direct payment to families, and it's going to be, and this is really unique and different than how child tax credits work now, it's going to be periodic payments that the IRS makes to these families, right? So just as you said, $300 a month for children under six, for each child under six, and $250 for children between 6 and 17. And so that will, the amount that you get will be based on the age of your children and the number of your children. And you'll get periodic payments if all goes as planned starting in July. And every, I mean, they're still determining all the details, but every so often after that, right? And then, of course, when you actually file your taxes, when tax time comes around, whatever the kind of remainder of the benefit is, there's an additional portion that families will get then. So you'll still get that bump around tax time, but you'll also be getting a regular amount in the time in between, which is really important for families, right? Because you don't have financial needs just one time per year. Now, the crux here is that it's for 1 year. It's only for 1 year. And so there'll be another political battle afoot a year from now when we're trying to decide whether this is a policy that we want to continue.
Mm. Well, Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, he's got another proposal that would last beyond that 1 year window. And actually, at least for younger children, would be the payments would be a little higher, $350 a month. And also, I think it would reach even some families with slightly higher incomes. Although we're still, of course, talking about families who are still struggling to make ends meet. So what are the important differences to understand between, let's call it, the Biden proposal and the Romney proposal?
Yeah, the key difference with our differences with the Romney proposal is that, first of all, Romney is proposing a permanent benefit. This isn't a 1 year thing that happens as a kind of function of a relief bill or a stimulus plan. It is a consistent and permanent benefit. The second big difference with Romney's plan is that this is not administered through the IRS, mm-hmm. right? So it's not a tax credit, it's an allowance. And so you get the kind of pro on the side of the Biden plan, which is this is a consistent benefit that families are going to get, as opposed to like a one-time thing you get once a year when you're filing your taxes, which tracks much more accurately to people's lives. But also, because it's not mitigated through the IRS, it's going to reach more people. One of the things that happens when we choose the IRS as a mechanism for distributing policy benefits is we limit who gets those benefits. There are people who do not file taxes, and these tend to be the folks who are most marginal and most vulnerable, either because they have a very, very low income or because they have a precarious relationship to the government in some other way. Maybe you live in a mixed status household and there's someone in your household who's undocumented. Folks like that are less likely to pay taxes. And we know that there are differences even across racial and ethnic groups, for example. So the decision to have something happen through the IRS has ramifications, and it means that these benefits reach fewer people and they reach people more inequitably. The Romney plan would really get around that, and it would be permanent.
I see. Well, we have another plan from Senators Mike Lee and Marco Rubio, which we'll talk about in a second, that would be administered through the IRS and is an expanded child tax credit. So we'll talk about that in a second. But as we head towards our first break here, Professor Michener, just check me on something. Regarding these sort of direct payments help children living in poverty, has the United States ever had anything like this?
You know, we've had kind of versions of this on a small scale. There have been experiments done or, you know, kind of pilot runs of different kinds of programs that involve direct cash payments. We haven't, and historically as well, we've had, you know, in different periods, we've given mothers pensions, for example. And so those were kind of direct payments. But we don't have an extensive history with this, and it's always been deeply politicized and vulnerable to kind of political pushback when this kind of direct payment, any kind of direct payment system is set up this way. I think there's a huge precedent for this internationally. Mm-hmm. In fact, if we look at the countries that have the lowest child poverty rates, they are the countries that had these kinds of direct payments. So Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and of course there are lots of differences between the U.S. and those countries, and that's something to take into account. But there's also a lot to suggest that this is the way. This is the way to tackle child poverty.
Well, Professor Jamila Michener, hang on here for a second. I've got a lot more questions about what child poverty advocates are talking about, what could be a momentous opportunity in American history. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the several plans currently circulating in Washington that could have a massive impact on child poverty rates in this country and whether or not we're at a turning point regarding doing something meaningful to lift millions of American children out of poverty. I'm joined today by Jamila Michener. She's a professor of government at Cornell University. Her research focuses on poverty, racial inequality, and public policy in the United States. And Professor Michener, before the break, you talked about sort of child allowances that we already know exist in other countries. And to that point, I just want to hear for one second from Professor Tim Smeeding, because in 2015, he served or he helped file a report with Congress about reducing child poverty. He served on the committee that wrote the report, and he's a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Professor Smeeding told us that they'd looked abroad to see what sort of cogent comparisons might be. And he says all of the countries they looked at had some form of universal child allowance program.
It made a huge difference in Australia. It was smaller in England, but in Ireland, but still there. Canada was just then passing their child benefit, which is about $400 a month a child. And now we have seen that rolled out. We have seen that's cut Canadian child poverty by about 40%.
Professor Michener, the claim coming from the Biden administration and congressional Democrats is that their plan could cut child poverty rates in the United States by 50%. Check that for us. Is that realistic?
I think it's entirely possible, and I do think it's realistic. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that there are a lot of unknowns, in part because we haven't done something quite like this in the U.S. in recent history. And so what the kind of poverty reduction effects are going to be dependent on a bunch of things, like what happens with the labor market. Do families that receive the benefit change their labor market behavior? What happens with these resources? How are they used? Are they used in ways that are going to be mobility enhancing, that are going to help families even more and maybe amplify the effects? It's possible that we could see more than that reduction, and it's possible that we could see somewhat less, but it's likely the right range, right? And so that's important because it signifies how very important and critical a policy juncture we're at. We're making a big decision now that's going to affect, millions of families. Mm.
And so I'm just referencing this 2015 report again that Tim Smeeding served on the committee that wrote the report for Congress. There's also this question of, okay, well, there's obviously current costs that we can account for, whether we're talking about benefits done through tax credits or direct payments. But sort of how do we wrap our heads around what the benefits to, you know, the entire nation could be down the line? And for example, and that's something that this 2015 report took a look at, and here's what Tim Smeeding said their major findings were.
Chapter 2, it says, all else equal, meaning no matter if the family situation, the neighborhood, the size of the family, the gender of the head, the race and ethnicity, all else equal, child poverty hurts kids, full stop. In other words, poverty itself has a causal impact in reducing kids' future lives and making them worse off, all else equal. No one ever said that before.
Professor Michener, so how do we then better understand what the benefits are to the not only these children and their families, but to the nation moving forward if we pull millions of American kids out of poverty?
Yeah, I think this is really important because we can think about short-term costs of a program like this, and we can forget to sort of account for all of the medium-term and long-term costs of doing nothing or of not doing enough, right? So whether we think about children across the intergenerational, across their lifespans, right? Children who are living in poverty are less likely to graduate from high school. They're less likely to go to college. They're more likely to be involved in the criminal legal system. Their health outcomes are on a worse trajectory. All of those things mean cost in the longer term, right? We're paying for those hospital care costs. We're paying for those costs around incarceration. We're paying for the loss of earnings in the labor market. And we're paying for the different things they're exposed to, whether it's exposure to, you know, to asbestos or lead paint or other things associated with substandard living conditions. And that's just if we think about the children, right? Because there are also costs incurred by parents who are navigating poverty with their children along some of those same metrics. Mm. And so it costs us much more in the medium and long term to either do nothing or to take insufficient action relative to what it costs us in this short term to implement an allowance program that is going to consistently pull children and families out of poverty.
Okay. So let's take a step back here, Professor Michener, because I do want to talk about the Rubio Lee plan in just a second here. But you know what we haven't done yet, and I should have done this earlier. My apologies. But we should talk for a second about really who we're talking about when it comes to American children who are living in poverty, right? Because it's disproportionately children of color, Black and Latino children. So there seems to be a sort of a compounding inequality here.
Absolutely. I think this is a critical part of the landscape of poverty in the U.S. more generally, but in particular, child poverty. 73% roughly of children living in poverty are children of color. Of course, these numbers are ever shifting because the COVID pandemic has really, challenged a lot of families and also disproportionately families of color. But we're talking about 30% of Black children who are living in poverty. Roughly the same number, about 29% of American Indian, Native American children. and approaching a quarter of Latinx children. And so while we don't want any children suffering, it's important to note that the nature of the suffering and the patterning of the suffering is racialized, so that when we decline, for example, to do something about these problems, we're not just sort of relegating children to these long-term and short and medium-term outcomes that are negative, but we're relegating children of color to these outcomes, which then perpetuates the various forms of racial injustice that we see in society. So this has been a big year for thinking about the criminal legal system and its connection to racial injustice. Well, look, that is downstream from where these children are now who are living in poverty. And so there are lots of things to do to address the criminal legal system, for example, downstream as it affects adults. But we should also be looking upstream and thinking about what is accounting for some of those patterns down the line. And so if we want to address racial justice, addressing child poverty should be near the top of our list.
So we have talked about what's in the Biden plan, what's in the Romney plan, and the distinguishing features thereof, that they're essentially forms of direct payments to families. Now, we already know that in terms of political support from the Republican Party in Congress, the Biden overall COVID relief bill doesn't have any Republican support. And I'm seeing here that because it's a direct payment plan, the Romney child poverty relief package or proposal wouldn't even have GOP support as well. So in a sense, the concept of direct payments is DOA with the Republican Party. But we do have a proposal from Senators Mike Lee and Senator Marco Rubio about expanding the child tax credit, increasing that tax credit to $3,500 a year for school-age children, $4,500 a year for younger children. And they're proposing making part of that credit refundable, which they say would actually reach families that don't make enough to file taxes. Is that a workable solution? Would it accomplish this major reduction in child poverty rates?
You know, this is, in many ways, it's an extension of more of the same, right? So we have a child tax credit, and that child tax credit was expanded as recently as 2017. And we know that that expansion had positive effects on many American families. So it's, you know, it's not to say that an expanded child tax credit compared to doing nothing is a bad thing, right? But what it does is distract us from the reality that there's an alternative that could have much wider and deeper and more transformational change. Will an expanded child tax credit in the ways that Rubio and that Senators Rubio and Lee are proposing, will it help some families? Will it help many families? Yes. Will it help as many families as either the Romney plan or the Biden plan? No, we don't have any reason to believe that it will, right? And if you think about what's at the heart of the difference here, and the core argument that Senators Rubio and Lee are making is essentially that a child allowance is bad because it goes to everyone and that makes it welfare, and welfare is bad. And until we get to a point as a country where we can reevaluate that assumption, we're going to keep bumping up against this same ideological wall, which is welfare is bad. We can't give people something for nothing. We can only give people something if they're working. And we can only know they're working if we deliver the benefits through this child tax credit mechanism. That's the only way to make sure that we're rewarding work. Well, who are you punishing under that kind of formulation and why, right? I think that until we say, actually, everyone living at a basic standard of human dignity is more important than whether we call this welfare and whether we see a minor dip in, you know, labor market participation, having children not live in poverty is the priority. And we work all the other policy details around that. That will get us to something much more like a child allowance. But if you say making sure no one gets welfare is the priority, not pulling children out of poverty, but ensuring that no one is getting this bad thing called welfare, And we'll build our policy around that. That's essentially what Senators Rubio and Lee's policy reflects. The core commitment is no welfare. The secondary commitment is help some children if you can.
Well, Senators Lee and Rubio are clear that, you know, they want a plan that, in their words, would reward work. And in fact, to get the full credit that they're proposing, individuals or couples in a family would need adequate income from paid work to qualify. So point taken. But on that note, let's turn now to Angela Rashidi. She's a poverty scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Nice to be with you.
So first of all, give us your big take. Is this a potentially game-changing moment for, pushing back against child poverty in this country?
Well, I think I don't necessarily think it's game changing. I mean, we are talking about kind of a mechanical issue. So I think the benefits of this child allowance have been extremely oversold from the perspective of statements like, oh, it'll cut poverty in half, things like that. I mean, what we are talking about is a poverty line, which is an income line. And yes, giving people a few extra $1,000 a year will bring them above that line. But I think if giving people more money solved the condition of poverty and had no unintended consequences, we would have done that years ago. But we know from research and from past experience that there are unintended consequences to these policies. And I think that the benefits of this have focused on only the positive, have been oversold, and have largely ignored the potential negative consequences.
So what are some of the unintended consequences you see?
Well, I mean, we do actually have a long history in this country of providing direct benefits to poor families. There was the Aid to Families with Dependent Children's program that operated up until the 1990s. That was different than a child allowance in the sense that families had to apply for it and be eligible. But if they were eligible, they did receive an unconditional cash payment. And that system became extremely unpopular because it was viewed as contributing to reduced employment, dependency on government, and really very high poverty rates. I think poverty rates among single mothers were about 60% at the peak of that program. So in the late 1990s, it was really recognized on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, that kind of a system just really had some bad consequences and could do some long-term harm to families by really reducing the importance of employment, reducing the importance of having two-parent families. And those are just a few of the kind of consequences of policies like this. And I think the debate is, you know, is a child allowance like that system? No, it's not exactly like that system. But I think that by not acknowledging the potential for those types of unintended consequences really does a disservice to the debate.
So this idea of the importance of work, you know, we've talked to many families over the past year, especially who, more than anything, want to work. But right now, in this sort of pandemic economy that we have, finding that work is more difficult than ever. And so the there's been no shift in their lives in terms of whether or not they want to work. And I think, actually, let me make an even more important point here. According to some census data that I was looking at from 2018, from their population survey, there was a economic and social supplement here, it found that regarding children living in poverty right now, one-third of these children live with a family member who already is working full-time year-round, and the majority of children living in poverty live with at least one working family member. So they are working, and they are still in poverty. So I don't understand about this incentive to work argument that I keep hearing.
Well, so I'm sure the poverty measure that you're referring to actually doesn't count all of the benefits those working families already get, and that's mainly the earned income tax credit. And when you factor in the earned income tax credit to the poverty measure, it shows that many of those families you're talking about are actually lifted out of poverty through a combination of work and the earned income tax credit. Putting that aside, though, there are benefits to employment that go beyond just the financial. There's a large literature on that. And so when I'm talking about these negative consequences about reducing the importance of work, I'm not talking about those families that are attached to the labor market, lose their job, and then come back into the labor market. I'm talking about those families that have really no work history, have a really, really hard time even entering the labor market. And when we set up a system in this country to provide cash transfers to those families, I don't think we're setting them up for much of a future without employment.
So, Angela, hang on here for just a second. I'm only interrupting because we have to take a quick break. And we'll get to the other side of that break. I'll let you finish your thought and hear some responses from Jamila Michener as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the various proposals working their way through Washington that could really push back against child poverty rates in this country. And I'm joined today by Jamila Michener. She's a professor of government at Cornell University. Research focuses on poverty, racial inequality, and public policy in the United States, author of the book Fragmented Democracy. Angela Rashidi also joins us. She's a poverty scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And Angela, before the break, I'm afraid I had to cut you off there because we had to do that break. But go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, I think I was just making the point that even if we provide families, non-working families with a child allowance, they're still going to be in poverty. And without employment, that means they really have a very limited future in terms of economic mobility, and they won't benefit from all the other benefits of employment, such as social networking, self-esteem, mental health, all those things we know come with employment. So I just think that those kind of things really aren't addressed when we're having these debates about child allowances.
Now, do you know specifically how many or what percentage of families or parents stay out of the job market when assistance is increased?
No, I mean, I'm not going to say precisely. There's a large literature, though, that looks at various policies that provide transfers like this and what that does to the labor market. And there's some debate over, because it's definitely hard to try to extrapolate findings from other research when the policies aren't exactly the same to determine precisely how a policy would affect a non-working population. But the literature largely shows that there will be a negative employment effect. We can debate how big it is and if it's meaningful or not, but the economics literature is pretty clear that there would be negative employment effects.
Professor Michener, how would you like to respond to Angela Rashidi's concerns about the employment effects?
I think that, it's true that the literature suggests a negative employment effect. I would say that most of the literature suggests a minimal negative employment effect. And at that point, we have to think about the options that we're weighing here, right? So if we see a 1 percentage point or 2 percentage point decrease in labor force participation rates among low-income families, but in exchange, we get, even if we say that the estimates are off and we're talking about a 20% decrease in child poverty or a 30% decrease in child poverty, no less a 50% decrease. I mean, it's a trade-off, certainly, but it's one well worth making. And I'll also say, you know, what really does labor force participation being decreased mean on the ground when we think about women like Wendy Brown, who opened up this show, right? So some of the work that I've been reading around what will happen, for example, in response to this child allowance offers a number, 277.4 million employment hours lost as a result of the child allowance, right? And some of the folks who have the perspective that this is a bad thing because of the labor market effect say, look at all these millions of hours lost. But that translates into maybe 1 or 2 hours a week for working women, right, or working families. And what can they do with those 1 or 2 hours a week? Can they spend more time with their children? Can they look after and take care of their health? Can they pursue activities that might actually give them opportunities for mobility, the kinds of opportunities that we're talking about when we say, let's not just think about pulling people above this arbitrary line. Let's think about giving them opportunities for mobility. Yes, let's give them opportunities for mobility. But that's not going to happen if they have to work two jobs and work 60 hours a week and run themselves into the ground just so that they can be quote unquote working. I think that we absolutely should think about the kind of labor market dynamics here. And if we want to think about labor market dynamics, we should be thinking about whether people are getting a living wage. Mm-hmm. We should be thinking about whether they have protections in the workplace. We should be thinking about what kinds of jobs they have access to. But when we say we don't want to give people benefits because it might cause a slight dip in them working, but we're not talking about how to make the labor market more robust and make it more fair and just for people who are living in poverty, well, that's an imbalance in focus that I think very much does a disservice to people living in poverty who are actually having to navigate labor markets that are not friendly often to their interests.
Well, so Professor Michener, though, let me follow up with one thing, though. There's no disagreement that the fact that more income helps families who are struggling with poverty, right? The question is, where does that income come from? Does it come through the federal government, through taxpayer dollars, or does it come through employment or some combination of the two? I'm just wondering if what is your argument against like crafting policies that ostensibly would lead to longer term solutions for families because they would be in better employment?
Oh, I have no argument against that, right? I mean, I think that this is more of a question of both end rather than either or. Mm-hmm. I think that policies that lead to sort of significant changes in the labor market such that families living in poverty have access to better employment that can allow them more economic stability and better than stability mobility. You know, yes, let's talk about the range of policies that can get us there. I will say that many of those policies are controversial and that many of the folks that are opposing a child allowance will oppose those policies, right, that make work more of a feasible pathway for people living in poverty. But, you know, until those options are opened up and unless they're opened up and even to supplement those options, we absolutely need the federal government to do what it needs to do to make sure that families are living above a certain sort of line so that they're not living in deprivation. And that is whether they work or not. And that there's a larger argument unfolding in the background here that we often don't state. And I think it's worth saying the quiet part out loud is, do we want people to work if they can and to be able to make and earn a living? Absolutely. Is work more important than basic human dignity? I would say no. So that if for whatever reason people are not working, they ought to still be able to eat. They ought to still have a roof over their head. Do we want to encourage people to like just loaf around and do nothing? No, but to be clear, that group of people who are like no work history, not tied to the labor market, let's think about who those folks are because they're not just numbers and statistics, they're people. And why wouldn't you have a work history? Why wouldn't you have a connection to the labor market? Because you're lazy and you just don't want to do anything with yourself? I haven't met very many people like that in my life. And I spend a lot of time with people living in poverty and grew up in similar circumstances. Let me tell you, people aren't connected to the labor market often because they have challenges around mental health, because they're doing care work that's uncompensated and caring for elderly parents, caring for disabled family members, caring for children, and doing other kinds of work that we don't acknowledge as work, but those things are work, right?
Well, let me get back to Angela Rashidi here and give her a chance to respond. Your response, Angela.
Yeah, I would just say, well, I guess maybe two things. I mean, one thing is that we do know how to actually reduce poverty. After welfare reform and expansions in the earned income tax credit in the late 1990s, we actually cut poverty by 40% in this country and until 2019, when it was the lowest pretty much on record when properly measured. The second thing I'll say is that, so I spent much of my career working for the Department of Social Services in New York City, working with the TANF program. So I have spent a great deal of time with families who have experienced these programs, and that has really shaped my views on this question of employment. I have no doubt, and talked to many families, they want to work. They desperately want to work. They want to provide for their families. But I also, it was very clear that these systems that are set up, and when the government is giving people money and it's easier not to work, people will even, they would tell me that it's the motivation is just not there. And they were looking for help to get into the labor market. They were not necessarily just looking for a cash transfer from the government. So that was a really formative experience for me, and really, really trying to see it through their eyes and see how these policies that are very well-intentioned, again, very well-intentioned policies trying to help families, help children, but they can have really negative consequences. And I think by ignoring those negative consequences, and also ignoring all the other benefits that are already available to people. So those non-working families, they're not going to go hungry because they have access to food assistance through the government. They have access to housing assistance. And that, right, at least currently, is not tied to employment. So I'm talking about this policy that will go into place that will not be tied to employment. And again, I feel like will have some negative consequences for those families that I knew and I met when I worked in New York.
Professor Michener, what do you think?
I think that, first of all, access to housing assistance in this country is abysmal, and only about a quarter of people who are eligible actually receive it. So that is very much a non-starter. We're in the middle of an eviction crisis, and we were already in one before the pandemic. Housing assistance is really limited and really spotty. Access to other forms of benefits is similarly spotty and limited and contingent. Some of these benefits, for example, the SNAP program for food and nutrition, are sometimes are attached to work requirements. And we have this hodgepodge, spotty system that is not providing for people's needs. Look, is it true that there were sort of cliffs before, and that there are cliffs in certain programs where when you cross a certain threshold, I make $1 too much, and so I'm not eligible anymore, and so let me make sure I don't work so much to cross that threshold? Absolutely. That is, you know, I'm engaging folks living in poverty all the time, and that is something that they say. I have to be careful of how much I work so that I don't become, like, not eligible anymore income-wise. I have never heard someone say, well, when I get this benefit, it just kills my motivation, right? It kills, what the benefit does is it changes the calculus I have to make about how much to work to ensure I stay eligible. But this idea that it has something to do with motivation, that it has something to do with desire to work, I actually think the evidence on that is extremely scant to non-existent. And I think that this larger narrative around, but we have these programs where we've given people money before and we see what happens, that is not a consensus. AFDC, ADC, these cash assistance programs, as much became unpopular because they were racialized and because they became kind of ideological tools for advancing particular political agendas, than because we had evidence that this kind of thing doesn't work. I think that in the context of a larger political economy where people do not have access to robust employment that allows them to live well and that allows them to not be in poverty, we have an obligation to provide people with other kinds of resources and the child allowance is an example of one. We can encourage work at the same time. We can have employment programs that help people, that provide people with training and provide them with other kinds of opportunities. But at the end of the day, we need low-wage workers, right? And the question is, the crux is, until we can have an economy where you can be a low-wage worker and still live well and live above a certain standard, then we need to have that work supplemented, and we need to take care of people, even people who don't work.
Right. So Angela Rashidi, we just got very little time left, I'm afraid. I'm wondering what you think about, it seems to me that it's kind of, you know, in the United States, we practice a form of policy paternalism on some groups, but not on others. And here's, you might tell me that this is a stretch in terms of a metaphor. But, you know, if we look at states, for example, there are some states that their net tax flows to federal coffers are much more than they get back in return. Other states, their net tax flows to federal coffers are less than they get back from the federal government. But no one's saying to those states, well, actually, what you need to do is you need to really boost your economy so you're paying into federal coffers more. Let's figure out ways to do that. Like, that's not even a part of the conversation. So why is it that we apply this kind of, again, policy paternalism is what I'm going to call it, to certain groups of people and you know, not others?
Because I'm struggling to see the parallel there with the states. I'm sorry. But yes, I mean, we do. We have paternalistic policies, that's for sure. But that's for everybody up and down the income scale. And yes, as an individual who really believes in personal freedom, that does bother me. Yes, but it's a trade-off. Again, you can transfer cash to households and it can increase their income, yes, but there are going to be unintended consequences. And I think we should take those unintended consequences into account.
Mm. So finally, of the three plans that we've discussed today, Biden, Romney and Rubio Lee, do you support the Rubio Lee plan since it's the one that's fully through expansion of tax credits?
I mean, it's of the three, I guess, but you can see I'm not like fully in support. I think we need a more comprehensive look at the benefits we already have in place, like an earned income tax credit, food benefits. We need to, if we're serious about helping families reducing poverty, it can't just be a one-off with a child tax credit or a child allowance. We need to really look at all of these programs together and figure out how we do the things we know are going to work, which is employment, strong families, and those are the things that are really going to help families thrive.
Well, Angela Rashidi is a poverty scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Michener, we've got 30 seconds left with you here. I was wondering if you wanted to give us a last thought. Do you still feel optimistic that perhaps some meaningful change could happen regarding child poverty rates in this country?
I feel optimistic. I don't know what will happen with these specific policies, but I feel optimistic because we're having this conversation and we're questioning the status quo. You know, as Angela Rashidi said, we've been doing a lot of things for a long time. I think I differ from her in the sense that I don't think those things have been successful. We keep bumping up against the same walls over and over again. Let's rethink our assumptions about work, about welfare, about human dignity. This is a chance to do that.
Jamila Michener is a professor of government at Cornell University, author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Thank you so much for joining us today. And in the last couple of seconds we have, I want to give a very special welcome to our new listeners at KNPR, Nevada Public Radio in Las Vegas. So excited to be with you, Las Vegas. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.